Okay, welcome everybody to the joint meeting. I will open the Committee on Environment and Energy. I notice we have a quorum, Legislator Marcotte, Legislator Nona, myself, and Legislator Burton.
And I will open the meeting of the Legislation Committee and we need another quorum as well. In addition to myself, we have Legislator Harkham, Legislator Burton, Legislator Burrows.
Thank you.
And Legislator Meyer.
And for both committees.
Right.
We are today discussing the county's MS4 local law. We have been working with the administration and the Committee on Environment and Energy to fast-track this. So our goal is to, if at all possible, vote this out by 1:30 for the blue sheet for tonight's meeting. We have discussed this twice in the Committee on Environment and Energy. This is the MS4s, or the stormwater permits that all municipalities have, and the county is a municipality, so we needed to pass something similar to the model local law that state DEC provided for our stormwater outflows. We have made some modifications to that. We passed it out of committee last week. There were some further minor modifications made, technical modifications made, and then it has now come to both committees where we would, if it is appropriate, vote it out for both public hearing and all purposes. So
that tonight we would set the public hearing and
right,
for the vote.
Right. So if you would all identify yourselves for the record, and perhaps because members of the Legislation Committee were not privy to our earlier conversations in environment and energy, just give them a little background, again, mindful of the time, on what the MS4 law is, why we have MS4s, and what this law says.
Okay, you want to do the introductions first?
Sure.
Dave Kavanga, Director of Environmental Planning.
Dave Smith, Vice
President. Monty Gleason, Associate County Attorney.
I'll give you a two-minute synopsis of the MS4 program and why we're doing this. The MS4 program is actually a mandate from the EPA. This is the Phase 2 implementation of the Clean Water Act. It is targeted at non-point source pollution generated from municipal separate storm sewer systems. That's the MS4 designation. All of Westchester's local municipalities and the county are all regulated entities under this permit program. New York State administers the NPDES program, the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program, for this Phase 2 stormwater program for the EPA through its SPEDES permit. So the county has a SPEDES permit for the MS4 stormwater. Part of that is to address, and this is again through the EPA, there's 6 minimum control measures, one of which is illicit discharge detection and elimination. So the state has requires some type of a law or regulatory mechanism. Every MS4 has to have a regulatory mechanism that prohibits illicit discharges to its system and includes an enforcement provisions. So the checklist, and Marty Brunkley will talk a little bit more about the term equivalency. The permit itself doesn't actually say adopt the state's model, but we do have to submit for the permit an annual report, which does have a checkbox that says the municipality's attorney or counsel has to check off that the MS4's regulatory mechanism is equivalent to the state's model law. So that's where we're at now, and I think that is why we have chosen to take the state's model law, tweak it where it definitely needed to be tweaked because it's really written for local municipalities, but tweak it for so it works for the county. Add some of the things in there that we have discussed, some of those tweaks, and we've made some additional tweaks with Chris, and get to this point.
So we should go through you should probably summarize the law for the Legislation Committee members who are not on environment, and then go through, point out where we've made the tweaks.
I would appreciate that.
Because Gordon is not, by the way, we're joined by Legislator Williams, Frieda Williams, who's on the legislation as well, but I don't believe on environment. So we need kind of an overview for them.
Perfect.
I'll give you a one-minute overview, and then I'll let Dave and Marty kind of fill in a lot of the gaps that I would leave. Basically, the law is the model law developed by, or implemented or promoted by the state has, or anticipates the Department of Public Works as administering the program. It does require permits for both illicit discharges and illicit connections. So illicit discharges and basically anything other than stormwater is considered an illicit discharge. There are a list of exceptions that are included in the law, such as car washing for a single-family home. I think sump pumps and footing drains and things of that nature are permitted as an exception. But basically, the law is designed to determine that any pollutants that are getting in the stormwater are considered illicit discharges. There's also a permit required for connections to the stormwater system. So anybody who wants to connect a pipe to the county's pipe, or even in some instances, a surface flow to the county system can be considered a discharge. Or a connection. I'm sorry. So some of those issues have been clarified with some of the recent amendments to the law. It also has sections for enforcement, and so it explains the permitting process in both of those instances, and it does have provisions for enforcement and lays out an enforcement process and penalties. That's basically it in a nutshell. I don't know if Dave or Marty want to kind of fill in the details.
I just wanted to point out that the major change from the model law to our pending law is the permitting requirements. We're actually proposing a stormwater connection permit like Dave talked about. And the purposes of that was, one, because we have to know where the conveyance system is, where the sources are generated, and if they're terminating at our outfall, we need to know where to go to investigate where it's coming from. And one part of that would also give us those pipes and those storm sewers and see what we do have and what drainage basins we actually are contributing to our stormwater systems. And that is more a way to collect the data, because if not, we'd have to go to the local municipalities. We'll eventually go to the local municipalities and get their assistance from knowing the buildings and what the infrastructure is. But that part is not required in the local level. We found that for logistically carrying out the program would be a benefit to the county.
So that's not in the state statute doesn't have a permitting requirement for connections?
That's correct.
And who, other than a municipality would connect, right? They could connect.
Yeah.
They would require a permit. And also a private, an individual homeowner wouldn't.
Yeah.
If they go through the municipality. What about a commercial establishment?
No, they would need, the way the permit reads is, the way we envisioned it, is there would be three different permits. One would be for a private homeowner.
Okay.
Because we do have private homeowners
connecting directly
into the storm basin. Two would be commercial, and the third would be the local municipality. Local storm sewers that end up terminating in our systems, so we need to know what conveyance is contributing to that.
And then there's requirements as to what can be discharged and what can't be discharged, and there's penalties for violating that.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
We did provide, I think, didn't we expand the waiver from the last meeting? We had a meeting in the Energy and Environment Committee on this. We expanded the waiver to allow a waiver in lieu of criminal prosecution, right?
That's correct. Yeah,
and that's in here.
That's been changed. Terminology out of the local law so that it gives us more flexibility and not going after.
So we can use this more as an educational tool as opposed to a punitive.
That's correct.
That's page 24 of the bill packet, section 822, page 17. Because if a person violates, I think this is important to make sure everybody's aware of this. If a person violates a provision of this chapter, other than being fined and thrown in jail, and they have no prior history, and the environmental damage was minimal, or they cooperated, they could get one of these other remedies that could be imposed upon them, and that's attendance at a compliance workshop, storm drain stenciling or storm drain markings, river stream or cleanup activities, and other activities determined by the commission. What's storm drain stenciling or storm drain marking?
beware leads out to Long Island Sound.
So you put actually a warning sign.
Right. Cool. Yeah. I forget the exact language, but it's...
Right. Now, if I can just add a quick little bit of background, when people are wondering why there is a penalty attached to an MS-4, through our other work with DEC on MS-4s, all of their model local laws require some sort of a penalty phase. They leave that loose so you can tie it to your local, so a town could tie it to their building code, however they want to do it. But they're very insistent that there has to be some sort of a penalty phase associated with all of it.
Now, just to be fair, Marty, you've got a memo here and that does warn about the problem of taking out the criminal penalties.
In prison.
Yeah. So everyone should be aware of that. I mean, can you just explain, so your opinion.
The question was whether or not the imprisonment penalties that are in the state's model law and also in the proposed law that's before the committees, whether or not those imprisonment penalties could be removed and still have the local law be equivalent to the state's model law. The county attorney wrote an opinion saying that without comparable imprisonment penalties, it would be difficult for the county attorney to say that the local law has any deterrent effect and thus was equivalent to the state's model law. So there's a recommendation by the county attorney that this local law have comparable penalties in the draft that's before the committees now has the same penalties as those in the proposed state's model law.
And to the point about the penalties, again, this when we first got this from the administration, it was in the form of an act. And a number of members of the committee on the Environment and Energy Committee felt that because there were penalties involved and things like that, it was really beyond the internal workings of county government alone, and the committee felt that it should be a local law so that it would rise to the level of a public hearing, so that, you know, if there was a potential for penalties, that we would receive input from the public on this. So that's why it's a local law. Now,
Have the criminal, the imprisonment penalty, but we do have the alternative, which dispenses, you know, and you're comfortable with that we can have the alternative?
Sure.
Okay. Just as long as we have somewhere a criminal penalty.
And you should point out, there's also civil penalties here.
Yes.
Another one.
Right.
Yeah. Now, you also made some technical amendments to this after it was passed with Chris Crane, counsel to Committee on Environment and Energy. Do you want to briefly go through those for the benefit, actually, of both committees?
Okay. Yeah, we met with Mr. Crane, Dave, Bill, and myself. And a couple of the changes that we made, if you look at page 1 of the proposed legislation, section 23.06, that had previously read prohibition of unauthorized connections. We changed that to now read prohibition of illicit connections, and that's because the term illicit connections is what's used in the state's model law. Unauthorized connections was something that we created in the proposed legislation. We wanted to make it closer to the state's model law and be less confusing. So any way you see the term illicit discharge, it probably replaces the term that we had before, unauthorized discharge. It's the definition. I should say, of unauthorized connections has been eliminated from the draft legislation. We have some technical site changes. We cited to the wrong section. Thank you, Mr. Frank, for pointing those out. And we made those corrections to the draft, so everything now is correctly cited in the legislation. In terms of the definition, we redefined the term person, because I think that we're having some difficulty being a little too narrow or perhaps a little too broad. So on page 6 now there is a new definition of the term person. This would relate to anybody who's violating the law, as opposed to, and this is a little different from the state's model law, which we all felt was a little bit restrictive in some ways and maybe a little bit overbroad in other ways. But it now reads any individual, association, organization, partnership, firm, corporation, or other entity recognized by law. Previously, it had read, it had also said, an acting either as the owner or as the owner's tenant, lessee, or guest. And we thought that language was perhaps a little bit restrictive and didn't capture all the people that may violate this law. So now, with this definition, we include a lot of other people besides just owner's agents and so forth. Okay. Yeah, some minor tweaking. If you look on page 19, this would be section 823.11, subdivision 12. That subdivision has now been retitled permit termination or modification. I previously read the permit renewal. And this is the section that allowed the Commissioner of Public Works to modify a permit when the speedies, speed permit changes, when our requirements with the state change. Previously said that he could do that upon a renewal. We wanted to make it clear that it's not just during renewal. You can terminate or modify at any point, whether it's at the renewal stage or otherwise. So that now reads permit termination or modification for it. And you'll generally at any point in time. Probably the major change. It's probably the major change.
Okay. We've got members?
Sure. We were joined by legislators Ryan and Rogowski.
Members, questions, comments? As we discussed also in environment, and I'm just, this is called filler here. Well, people think there are questions. This, as Dave Kavinga mentioned, you know, this is part really enforcement of the Clean Water Act. This is something we have to do by DEC. We don't have a ton of flexibility. I mean, we do have a little bit of flexibility within this law. So, you know, if you want to tweak something here or there, you know, we can certainly entertain that. But unfortunately, we basically have to pass something very similar to this, and we have to do it soon, which is why we've been working with the administration to fast-track this. So,
and who actually will go out and enforce this? It's the DPW, right? It's,
yeah. And the law itself is the Commissioner of Public Works is the person who's overseeing the whole law and the implementation of law. But he'll use how it's being done right now is that there's a branch of public safety that'll go out and actually you know, hunt down inspect that. And they've done it before in the past.
All right.
We're actually just putting it on record how it should break down officially, but it's been going on.
Yeah, but they do have an environmental. They still have their environmental section. Yeah. They haven't eliminated that.
Yeah, well, both public safety and Department of Health are very involved in doing the inspections and tracking down illicit discharges.
Legislator Burton,
who is the person in public safety who does this, and why is that person doing it rather than in say the health department?
Ron Gatto is the officer that does the environmental police, if you will, for the county. He's usually we usually call him in as a last resort, only when you need somebody with handcuffs and the police power to really kind of take action. I think the health department has actually done an excellent job in tracking, finding these illicit discharges, or when they are found through an inspection program, doing the sampling to then follow up with the local. Usually it's local municipalities when our health department gets involved. We haven't found too many of the county outfalls that have illicit discharges, but so usually our health department would then work with the local municipality and their enforcement officials if necessary to make sure that whatever property owner has to do whatever they have to do.
But there is from time to time the necessity of having someone who, as you say, has handcuffs?
Yes, yes.
It happens enough that you wouldn't want to combine those two positions?
I think the health department has specific expertise in actual doing water quality sampling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, taking the sample, you have to be certified to take the samples and then bring them to a lab and then follow up with the reporting and whatever is necessary. They also work with the DEC if necessary for in enforcement issues if they would get involved. But Ron will also enforce, he'll also get calls directly too. Somebody will be driving down the Bronx River Parkway and say, hey, I saw somebody dumping something out of their car. And he'll respond, immediately and as well to the health department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Any other questions? There's also in your packet, as a follow-up to the last meeting, a series of questions that were posed by the Environment Committee and Council thanks to Chris. And here are the written responses as well. So let the record reflect on that. And thank you for getting us those so quickly.
Yeah, and this should be part of the legislative history of, in case any questions arise as to why changes were made. I have two follow-up
questions. Sure, absolutely.
So we're already kind of enforcing not this law, because we don't have it yet, but the requirement that there be appropriate hookups and discharges, right? It's just not done in this way.
Yeah, we had discussed that at previous meeting. There are existing sections of the county charter that do prohibit essentially the same thing. They prohibit pollution of the county's water, connections to the county's piping system, and we do have a permitting program. DPW manages a permitting program right now,
right.
For connections to that. So. But again, going back to what Marty said, the section, what we had to do is find something that was in order for it to be substantially equivalent
right.
to the state's model
yeah.
law, we were really kind of looking at adopting this, codifying this whole new law.
Do you have any plans for an educational outreach to let people know this new law will now come into effect and it replaces existing?
That's something that we could talk about a little bit more, with DPW. I think that I think the intent has always been we're not going to start throwing people in jail, but certainly to give people a substantial grace period in which to comply, at least for the first year of the laws, so that certainly we don't really want to enforce. We'd rather educate. And really kind of go through it that way. We do have an education and outreach program through the planning department, which we were just kind of hitting the ground with that, getting a lot of materials out there. So stormwater should be on everybody's some familiarity with that, but with not necessarily the specifics of this law.
Thank you. I apologize for. You might have had some senior citizens to attend to. I'm interested in this, the permits and the financing. You say eventually this program will be revenue neutral, expense neutral, because people will pay to get a permit. I'm trying to read through this. Can you explain? There's someone who has a Speedy's permit will not need to get another county permit. They can use their Speedy's permit. So that's a group that we're not going to get any revenue from. Right. I guess one of my questions, Mr. Chen, I haven't been as close to this legislation as you guys have been, is sort of examples of who's in on this. If I see, are residential homes exempt? Did I see that or not? People who live next to a county road, let's say, or something, they're going to have to get a permit to hook up into our system? Was there any discussion, and again, I'm not sure of the panoply of who all the potential applicants are. It's a little unclear to me who's out there getting these permits and how many. I don't know if you said 10 a year, 100 a year, 1,000 a year. I don't know if you went down that road yet. But to the extent that they're part of any kind of construction project where they would be getting a local permit, I see in the legislation this doesn't absolve them from getting all their other permits. Was any thought given in the drafting some kind of delegation, when the feds do something, they delegate to the state. Here we're creating, I guess, pursuant to state law, we have no choice because we're creating another permit. But if someone is filing the local town to get a building permit and, all the other permits they get, is there a way, now DPW is issuing permits, if I read this right, and I don't know who knows, to go find DPW. Within the framework of the local municipalities, is there a way to either delegate this authority or somehow interconnect this permitting process with existing permitting processes somewhere else?
The majority of all the conveyance systems are on county roadways. So whenever there's work being done on the county road, they have to go for a building approval. So during that process, the building approval stages, as we move forward, after all the existing connections per se have been discovered, if they do depend on pending a new connection to that permit, we will just have them. We want to separate a stormwater connection permit from a building approval permit for two reasons. One is that all building approvals won't necessarily connect to stormwaters. And number two is once they satisfy their building permits, those permits go on file, and that's it, where the stormwater permits are open or subject to additional requirements, depending if we receive additional requirements with DEC. So we wanted to see if we could separate those two, because once you do get a building permit and you get an approved connection, if you satisfy building that structure to code, then the permit is satisfied and it's rendered complete. Whereas if that connection is still connected into the basin, then you do commit an illicit discharge. Now we have to either prevent that discharge from happening, and the purpose of that permit was to make sure that we know what stormwater is being conveyed into our system, so we can go after that.
So you have, they have.
Excuse me, Marty. Can we just interrupt for one second? Sure. I know Legislator Kaplowitz is here. We want to acknowledge that. For the record,
Mr. Chairman, I understand the Environment Committee has moved, and seconded, and voted positive for this.
No,
item.
We haven't voted on it.
Well, last week we did, and now we have a slightly different
changes.
Version.
Okay.
Well, and the Legislature Committee has not voted on it yet.
Okay. Okay.
So it's before joint meeting.
Got it. Are you going to entertain a motion for the Environment Committee, separate and apart from public?
We would
at some point. Okay.
Yeah, within the next few minutes, we've got to get it on the blue sheet. Sorry.
And I appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. I know we're balanced here between something we sort of have to do, right, but still, at least in legislation, trying to draft something that, you know, that makes sense and works. So I'm trying to follow this. So someone's going to get a permit to connect to our stormwater system. DPW issues that permit. But we want that separate from everything else, because somewhere down the line, 6 months, 2 years later, to the extent there might be an illegal discharge into that system, we want to be able to enforce it. Okay, I mean, that's the structure, I guess. But between the permitting process of having DPW in that loop, and then on the enforcement end, it's almost like the guns, I don't want to mix gun storage, but we're setting up something that we're probably only going to enforce like after the fact. There's got to be some fiscal impact to that. I mean, if we're permitting up front, and then we're going to be either going out proactively looking for discharges or waiting, as we heard, like with gun storage, after the fact, someone discovers a discharge, and then, you know, I'm just trying to follow the whole process. And is there not another way, again, unless this is the model of state law that we can't change, between the fiscal impact and just, forget fiscal, the stuff that Mike does in his committee, coordinating all these permits being issued, you have a goal of wanting this other issue of the permit here. But how many building departments, I mean, who's going to know that they've got to come, there's not a good way to do it, but they've got to come to DPW for another permit. If it's not integrated into the local system, it ain't going to happen. And then the enforcement, so I'm concerned the fiscal impact says no fiscal impact. I mean, it's easy to say that. Somehow, I have to believe there's going to be staff time spent up front and ongoing, so I don't really buy those numbers. And I don't know if we're talking 100 permits a year, 1,000 permits a year, what are we talking about?
Just to clarify, as far as inspecting outfalls and determining if there's illicit discharge, that actually falls under our MS4 permit. So that's why those finances weren't included into this permit. The permit finances only to implement and to upkeep the permit itself. But when we go out 25 every year, we have to under our permit requirements inspect 20% of our outfalls.
Okay, so we're inspecting under our own permit. Now these are permits we're giving to other people hooking into.
No, those are the permits that the DEC
gives
requires
to us.
Right, but this legislation now takes it to the next step.
Yeah, the main purpose of this legislation was to get a one way was to get the actual conveyance system coming into. Yeah.
I guess maybe, and I'm not steeped in all the history. This is the state law. They want us to do this. So, you know, you're trying to make something. The state says, go do this. If you think it through, it's maybe a nice idea. But if you really get to the nuts and bolts of implementing it, you know, it's a practical matter. And I haven't worked at the local level. Some of my colleagues have. With all the building departments, I see problems.
Legislator Kaplowitz, then Legislator Myers, then Legislator
Chairman, I don't know where to go with that.
Certainly, absolutely support. I see the changes that are made. I'd like to move it for environment if that's appropriate. If it's not appropriate this time, I understand.
No, we can entertain a motion and continue to discuss if you so like.
I would so move forward in our committee at this time.
Second.
Okay.
Do you want to, if I may, talk to the, because this reminds me also of the existing stream control law that the county has permitting authority. And I know that, I know for a fact that that works very well, and because I've seen certain developments held up because of it. I wonder if you could use that as a basis for talking about how this would work as well. I mean, I know that somehow developers are told they have to apply to the county. I don't know who tells them. Is it the building department, the planning?
Yeah, the building department. Okay. Section 239 of general municipal law requires these referrals to the county commissioner of public works. So the local municipalities, the building officials are very familiar with those referral process that Dave was just talking about. And I think within the Department of Public Works, having one or two people, they do all those referrals. And I think you do most of the 239 referrals. So there you get, that's where you kind of get the belt and suspenders.
There is a mechanism.
They'll in reviewing the 239 referral, you can also look at whether a stormwater permit is connection permit is needed.
And as a spokesperson for anti-flooding, an anti-flooding person, this also helps with regards to flooding, as does, you will see coming before you shortly a revised stream control law that actually expands the ability of the county to control the streams. Because all of this does have an impact. This is part and parcel. Not only is it water quality, it's water quantity. And all of this stuff is going into our waterways and contributing not only to junk in the water that upsets the quality, but also stuff that actually affects the quantity.
If I can, Mr. Chairman, quick question.
Yes.
I gather every local municipality also has to have the law. So maybe that's where the connection we made. We're sitting here focused on those county hookups, but if the town of Harris has to have its own law, and so its building department
they
will
do.
Be focused on this. And maybe in that context, oh, by the way, looking at theirs, there's this county piece, so maybe that's, it's not just the county coming out of left field, the locality has its own permit program, so that may be helpful.
And the new MS4s require most property owners now on, correct me on the size of the lot. I think it's larger than like half an acre or something. Stormwater has to be dealt with on site now.
Yes.
So it's there not going to be that many connections going forward because it's not like we're going to be dumping 1,000 gallons an hour. It's got to be dealt with on site.
Right.
So if I can, because I think I mentioned this before, on my street there's
some
a new house and there's a pipe. As I found the pipe running into the stormwater.
Some pumps are okay.
That presumably is saying
drains.
Some municipalities don't allow it though because of icing.
Right, but if
are allowed.
So they could still run
the state
with their property. I thought it was taking groundwater probably. I don't know who's taking
groundwater. Could be. I mean, groundwater is high groundwater is technically not an illicit discharge.
Right, so
it's an exception.
Groundwater can be steered into the
right. Yeah, the local municipalities have additional requirements for other laws, including a stormwater law. And
right.
Okay.
So we don't get caught up in
so.
Yeah, a lot of them won't allow it at all.
And
questions? Above all, you don't want to put this into your sanitary sewers.
Right.
All right.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see Legislator Marcotte nodding her head vigorously as we've gone through some of these things.
She just came from
because
the
she comes from a town where pain is measured in the number of times MS4 is brought up, I suspect. But it is something that actually goes back, at least in my experience, a good 20 years now with some of my more benighted constituents thinking that the way to change their oil was to pull up over a storm drain,
okay.
Pull the plug, plug it back up, and then put the new oil in. This is really, we've come a long way on this, and the fact that it may appear to be the nanny state going wild here, it is in fact something that is built in now to, I think probably, I mean, Gordon indicates that it's certainly done in the cities, and Ms. Marcotte and I know that it's been just part of the way you do things in towns and villages. So it's not a big it's not new. All it is really is codifying something that in a lot of cases has been around for a very long time. And I don't think that this is going to show up on anybody's radar unless they're really looking for something to plague you about, right?
Actually makes things clearer.
Yeah.
All right, so we have both a public hearing resolution and the legislation, so it would be for all purposes. It's been moved and seconded in environment.
Do you have a motion and a second for legislation?
Seconded.
Moved by Legislator Burroughs, seconded by Legislator Myers. Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None?
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you all. Thanks again for coming, and this was a good partnership. It was a pleasure. Thank you all. We'll now entertain a motion to adjourn environment.
So moved.
Okay. All in favor?
All right.
Aye. Mr. Chair, your meeting.
Yeah, we will now move to legislation committee items. First item is a resolution for a waiver for Stuart Glass. As you all know, Mr. Glass served as executive director of CalPUSA.
Right. Mm-hmm. Marty would know this.
He shifted over from
Marty's committee since the year one.
He shifted over from the county attorney's department to CalPUSA. Now he took the retirement package and
we're continuing.
Are we signing this still?
So just environment.
Yeah, we have to. No, we passed that. We have to sign that too. We're not adjourned. The meeting's not adjourned.
Oh, okay.
So we have a cover letter from him explaining his request that we allow him to become a paid consultant.
I didn't hear you, John.
Because he's...
Stuart Glass is asking to become a paid consultant to the county. He was the executive director of the what we affectionately call CalPUSA County Westchester Public Utility Service Agency.
Is this coming from the administration?
Well, I don't know. I would assume so, but it would be nice if someone from the administration explained to us. Maybe Mr. Glass is here. He can explain to us. We all know him very well.
Jim.
Oh, Jim. No, where is
Marvin?
He's not. Stuart is not here.
I saw George Arrows just a minute ago. Maybe we get him.
Chairman, Stuart is retired.
Yeah, but he's trying to become a consultant now.
That's correct.
Right, so we...
But who is this coming from is what we're trying to find out.
Looks like it's a letter to Ken.
From Stuart.
It's on Mr. Glass's letter.
My feeling is
the individuals. They have to. We can't prepare them for them.
Okay. He says CalPUSA has expressed interest. It's really CalPUSA.
But shouldn't they come and tell us?
CalPUSA should say they're
right. What's the need and why they're
I like Mr. Glass. He's excellent. He knows
Mr.
What
Chair, if I may, the Environment Committee has, as soon as Stu was terminated,
so he took the return effect.
Well,
yes.
Depends on who you ask. We immediately invited CalPUSA in so they could inform us as to what their future plans were and future needs. So we're waiting to hear back from them, right, Chris?
Yes, to schedule. Well, I join you, Mr. Chairman, in that I would like at least whoever feels there's a need for Mr. Glass to add his services, I'd like to find out why directly from them before we start putting people on.
There was an additional question, Mr. Chairman, of the duration and value of the contract, which I thought we had pretty much put into formal practice. There's no point in bringing a matter like this up before the committee unless and until we have those pieces of information.
We need terms.
Right, right. So can we just table this, Mr. Chairman?
Excuse me?
We just table this?
Yeah, I think we should table it. Sure, Mr. Chair, we're joined by Chairman Jenkins.
Thank you.
Somebody's telephone.
Somebody's phone.
Somebody answer their phone.
Right? Yes, right?
Maybe it's over there. Is somebody on electronic?
Oh,
it's
on, like, the call-in thing. It's going.
Somebody might be.
Okay, yeah, Bill. What do you want me to do?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for that. It's impressive.
The phone stopped ringing. The floor is yours.
Obviously, he has power.
I don't think that's the case. Mr. Chairman, my understanding is the waiver is a separate requirement based on the ethics. the rules of the ethics law. It is not necessarily connected to a contract. He may never, a person that is requesting a waiver may never get a contract. However, the requirement in the charter is that you are requesting the ability to be able to work for Westchester County. So in this case with Mr. Glass, it's a different scenario because we do understand from the CalPUSA perspective, and maybe Mr. Bukowski, because he's Mr. CalPUSA, understands it better, right, that there are several items that he is working on that were revenue generating for the people of Westchester County, that he was going to the various utility agencies and getting us reimbursements on specific dollars. For whatever reason, I thought the last one was $1.5 million or $2 million that we were overcharged by the New York State Power Authority. What is it?
Yeah, NYPA.
NYPA, right? NYPA was charging us extra. He was doing some study with the lighting, the street lighting, the traffic signaling, and that the charges that we received from that. So that is what he was working on. And they have a separate board as far as the charter is concerned, and they have the ability to contract out with someone should they choose. The waiver process is separate from that. So the person may never do that, but they have to request a waiver from the board based on the ethics law to allow that to happen. Sure. Bob shaking his head. They're not connected. He may not ever do that. And this, and obviously we go into our second part, you know, as far as the ANC portion is concerned, because some of the members' questions center around the kind of terms of a contract someone might be offered. I'm suggesting, again, it's two separate processes. Mr. Glass may never have a contract that is approved for services, but he wanted the ability to at least put his information in front of the organization in CalPUSA's case to be able to do that. If they don't have that waiver, technically they're not even allowed to request an opportunity to work. I mean, we have some questions on other individuals that we understand that have retired from the county that are working under specific guidelines that don't have contracts. They did not go for a waiver process. I don't know why, and we're really trying to sort through that. But from Mr. Glass's perspective, again, I think that the matter is really separate. Should we want to make a modification in the charter and in the law to say that you want to understand and connect what things they might be doing for the future, that's certainly something that we could and should maybe consider. But the opportunity, they're totally separate. They have to request the waiver to do this.
Well, I have to respectfully disagree, because this resolution that we're asked to pass says that we rely on his expertise, they need him, we're passing this waiver to accept, so that he can accept the position as a paid consultant. This is not some hypothetical, well, just waive it, and then in the future, maybe we'll hire him. This obviously, a request or an offer has been made for him to continue as a consultant.
There's something in the works.
It's not a hypothetical, and I think, otherwise, what criteria do we use to decide whether we just issue a waiver and then somebody else worries about it down the road? I think to make an intelligent decision on whether we're going to waive this, we need to know, you know, who wants the person, why they want him, you know, what's the benefit to the county, and what have they discussed any terms? Maybe they haven't discussed terms, but if they have, we should know what they are, so we can make an intelligent decision.
The point I'm making is that the processes are, the ways in the charter, Mr. Chairman, is separate. Now, again, in fairness, looking at the request, specific request, it says that they want to continue. Certainly having, I guess, the chairman of the board for CalPUSA to come in and deal with that certainly should be something that's what you are requesting. Let them come in and do that. I would again remind that the board itself, the members of the board are volunteers as opposed to employees. Mr. Glass was the only employee of the organization, if I recall. So again, I know that was what they were working on. And certainly, if that's what the pleasure of the committee is, then that makes sense to have him come in and have that. The CalPUSA folks should do that. At least, you know, maybe we can do it, Mr. Chairman, whether it's through through the appointments or have a legislation committee meeting that's tied to their availability, because I'm not sure, again, when the CalPUSA board member or whoever there is representing the board, I would assume it's their chair that would do that.
Legislator Harkin. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to you, Mr. Chair, perhaps you missed this when you first came in. The Committee on Environment and Energy, we've already requested that they come in to tell us what their needs are. So, you know, I'm a big fan of Stu's. I think he brings great value to the county. We've documented the millions of dollars he's saved the taxpayers. But I've got to say, you know, it's a little weird that we've requested CalPUSA to come in and tell us what they need and how we can help them in that process, and then a waiver shows up and they haven't spoken to us yet. So, you know, I'm as I said, I'm a champion of Stu's. I'll help push this through, but I think I'd really like to have CalPUSA come in, say what their needs are, what Stu's going to work on, and then they're, you know, legislators like Legislator Burton can get it. I mean, Burroughs can get his question answered, and we're all hunky dory.
Legislator Gusky, you want to weigh in on this? Since you're
on the CalPUSA? No, I think. I think it's certainly very appropriate just for CalPUSA and then for the process. If we have someone who's coming in, and I said we all know Stu and work with him, he sends a letter saying basically I need a waiver so I can go work with CalPUSA. I don't think this is the case, but just suppose Tom Geiger or CalPUSA says, "Well, we don't want to work with this guy," you know. So I think just for the record, I think Chair Arkham and Johnny, I think you guys are exactly right. As much as assuming CalPUSA says yes, we don't have anybody, we need somebody, let's move forward. But until we have that in the record, I think it's very appropriate. Just on process.
So should we
hold it?
Just hold it. I wouldn't hold it. And hopefully, Tom Geiger, as far as I know, is still the chair of CalPUSA, and
he is.
And I'll ask. So, Chris, will you reach out to them again and say it? You know, it's both committees now. It's not just environment and energy. It's legislation too. You know, it's got ramifications for both committees. We'd love to help them out, support them, but we need them to come in and tell us what they're doing and what their needs are.
I think if I can, this before this board acts, the committee acts on anyone's waiver for any process, we need to know that. There's a job at the other end.
Mr. Board Chair, do you know what section of the charter deals with the waiver? Just so we know what the waiver section says.
It's in the ethics code.
21, yeah, that's what I have.
21.
What's the
I-3.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, yes.
I just wanted to mention that at their August 10th meeting, the CalPUSA agency passed two resolutions. One was a resolution saying that they have authorized to seek proposals for a consultant to provide services to the agency for the period August 16th to December 31st. And that's what it said. It was not specific to any individual. It just said that they were going to seek consultants. The second resolution was a resolution to authorize, this is what it says, request that Mr. Glass continue to have access to his materials.
But that section, by the way, says no reporting officer or employee shall, upon termination of employment with the county, become employed by or accept the position of paid consultant to the county or any agency thereof within a period of 1 year following such termination, unless such consultation be first approved by the Board of Legislators. So, I mean, it's pretty broad. I think we need to know, you know, what they want, why they want them, what they want them for. And
Mr. Chair, just to bring closure to this.
Make a motion or?
Staff counsel to E&E will contact them once again, see if we can get them in to find out what their specific plans are and whether they relate to Mr. Glass. And then if they do, and they do want Stu, then I think we have sort of a gentle person's agreement that we'll fast-track this waiver.
Sure. Yeah, we all recognize he's been very valuable to the county for his expertise in the area of energy savings and conservation. So, okay, so that's that. Next item on the agenda. Why don't we get the minutes done?
They did. Thanks.
We have minutes from the last meeting. Let's just. You have a motion.
And move with the potential modifications, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I think I may have some modifications, yes, too. Yes, Mr. Burt. This is the minutes of August 3rd.
All right, so move them with the potential modifications, which I'm not prepared to give at this time.
Second.
Yeah, I would like the person to review the tape, and I just recall Judge Champion saying a little bit more about the permit application process, and his comments on the letter that was sent 3 years ago by 7 judges, and I'd just like somebody to review the tape and put a fuller discussion of what Judge Champion said. Thanks. Okay, so now we'll move to the next. So we won't take a vote on that. Now we will move to our star attraction of the afternoon, Mr. Jim Robertson. This is part of our ongoing review of the Board of Acquisition and Contract. I thought it would be helpful for us to have an overview from someone who has a great deal of expertise in the area of county procurement and county contracts as to how a contract gets to AMC for approval. As part of our background and looking at what, if any, reform needs to be accomplished for the AMC process. So I'm going to turn the floor over to Mr. Robertson, who's been kind enough to put together about a 20-minute PowerPoint, and is available to answer questions.
Okay, I'm going to start off by saying this is a grossly oversimplified view, and I gave Betsy my other grossly oversimplified view, which is 99 pages that I give to all departmental contract monitors, and I warn them when I give it to them.
Well, remember your target audience here.
We're overly simple.
We're grossly oversimple.
We have very short attention spans.
What I try to do is the mechanics of how we get to ANC for various types of contracts and try to flavor it with some of the rules of the economics.
Okay.
To try to give you something a little substantive. Okay. First question, the topic I was asked is how do contracts get to ANC? So the first question is why do they go to ANC? And I think you've seen from the legislation that's before you now, the reason why they go to ANC is Section 16111 says they have to. ANC has to award all contracts on behalf of the county unless specifically excluded. The main contracts that are excluded are purchasing contracts. They're under the jurisdiction of the purchasing agent. We have a separate purchasing act, which is Chapter 836 of the laws of Westchester County. Also, as you'll recall, WCC around, I think it was 98-99, was given certain freedoms, and they were allowed to have their own purchasing agent. So they've got a separate purchasing operation out there. Purchasing is purchase, sale, rental, maintenance, or repair of supplies, materials, and equipment. There's a big exception here you'll note in the parentheses. Except for contracts for rental, leasing, or licensing of equipment at a rate of $3,000 or more per month. So when you see those big computer contracts, that's why they're going to ANC and not through the purchasing agent. We're doing something that's a lot of money, or like the copiers, that's over $3,000 a month. That's why they go to ANC and not through the purchasing agent. The other thing is what we affectionately call short forms. I don't know where they ever got the name for this. It was there before I started working. But what it really is talking about is an exception in the ANC section of the charter. It's 16111C, which allows the county executive, pursuant to a resolution of the Board of ANC, to issue written authorizations to the heads of departments, boards, or commissions to sign contracts up to a maximum amount. Now, it doesn't say what that amount is, so it's set forth in the resolution, and you don't need any further approval of the Board of ANC. Historically, and this goes back when I started in contracts, which was during the O'Rourke administration, spend $20,000, an amount not to exceed $20,000, and for a period not to exceed 1 year. Again, during the Spahn administration, when they started that to try to give more freedom to the WCC, they were given 5 years and up to $100,000 where their board of trustees approves the contract. So there is another public meeting where they approve these, but they have a much greater amount in their short form authorization. All right, these are the typical types of contracts that go to ANC for approval. You'll see them on the average calendar for ANC, public works bid awards, contracts exempt from public bidding that go through OGS, that's the State Office of General Services, emergency contracts, as Chairman Jenkins knows, there's procedures for those. something called preferred source procurement. You'll often see contracts with an agency called NYSID, New York State Institute for the Disabled. Then next is contracts for architects, engineers, and land surveyors subject to pre-qualification and selection. This is actually an important one because the board actually was ahead of the state in something, and I'll explain that later. And then finally, the procurement policy. I think everyone wrongly assumes the procurement policy controls everything, and really it's limited to just professional services that aren't architects, engineers, and land surveyors. It's actually a very small subset of what we do. Okay, well, starting with public works contracts. Now, like I said, this is a grossly oversimplified overview. Most of them are pursuant to a capital budget and a bond act. Some public works contracts actually go through the operating budget. Those would be for maintenance. But the majority of the ones you'll see are usually under the capital budget and pursuant to a bond act because we don't do cash to capital anymore. Most things that we build, we just bond. The project has to be designed, so you'll usually have seen a separate contract for an architect, engineer, and land surveyor that preceded this. Then they use that design to prepare a bid specification. The engineers do that downstairs in DPW, or if it's really complicated, sometimes we go out to a private consultant to prepare the bid spec. The first step in the process is a resolution called authority to advertise. We do this because the law, both New York State, Section 103 of the General Municipal Law, and also our own public bidding law, which is found in the ANC section, it's section 16111 sub 2, where we have our own tighter bidding requirements, require that you publish in a newspaper and that you set the amount of security for the contract. So these are the two things that are key in the authority to advertise resolution. So for a public works contract, that's the first thing you're going to say. Now what I'm going to talk about now is something physical. This is how we actually get the things to ANC, and this will apply, I'm doing it in the middle of public works, but it's going to apply to all of the contracts.
But in this situation, a bond has been, you're talking about a bond has been passed approving.
Well, or it could have, like I said, there are exceptions in their operating budgets, but what I'm talking about now are mechanics. So we've got the authority to advertise resolution that we're ready to submit to ANC. Now this is mechanically what's going to happen next. The departmental contract manager is going to upload it into an electronic system called OnBase. Your staff does the same thing now. We've gone paperless. Everything gets uploaded into OnBase. This happened, I think, September 2008 we started this. Resolution goes into a queue in OnBase that goes to ANC staff. So when I submit something from the law department or you submit something from the board of legislators, it goes into ANC. They check for basic items like spelling, grammar, format, and they're also required backup materials you have to give with resolutions, usually prior resolutions if you've had a similar contract. If you've done an RFP, they want to see the backup on your RFP, usually the summary sheets, things like that, you know, how you made the decision for selection of the vendor. If it's a bid, they want to see your bid sheets and all the backup information. Okay, so that all gets submitted and uploaded in several documents that go into a little electronic, they call them queues, but it's just a little subsection of a desktop that you see when you open up OnBase. ANC reviews it. Now, I'm a member of pre-board, so I know what the next step is. This is what I see next. After it goes through the ANC resolution, then usually on a Tuesday, although with a short week like this week, they may be a little late, resolutions pop up into what's called our pre-board queue on OnBase. And then those of us who belong to pre-board start reading them and to look at them. Pre-board usually occurs the following Friday. So if everything goes right, I'll be getting my resolutions this afternoon. I can start reading them. Pre-board members can use OnBase. And what I do, particularly when I go through the resolutions, I try to get them done as quickly as possible. I'll email departments if I see legal problems with something, particularly a procurement thing that's an issue or I have a question about it. But OnBase has all kinds of functions in it, so you can actually communicate with the individual who submitted the resolution. So it's actually very helpful. Okay. Now, like I was saying, I reviewed the authority to advertise for legal sufficiency. The other members of pre-board prior to the meeting may have other questions. They use OnBase to ask those. The Board of Legislators, for example, in a public works project, always wants the estimate of a project cost. There's another part of OnBase called the narrative, where we sort of list what our questions are. DPW will always put the first entry into an authority to advertise resolution is the estimated project cost. This gives that information to the Board of Legislators. That's basically why it's put in there, so that your staff knows what the cost is, or the estimated cost is. Once the resolution, well, we have the meeting on Friday at pre-board, and then if it passes through pre-board and there are any problems, it should be on the ANC resolution for the next week. Then the resolution will be voted on. Once approved, the department, now we've got the authority to advertise. The advertisement takes place under state law. You only need 5 days between publication of advertisement and bid opening. Under the county law, however, you need 10 days. So there's a minimum of 10 days. And if you know the Journal News, it takes another 5 days to get the ad placed. So we're usually talking about a week and a half, 2 weeks just between the publication. The bid specifications can be downloaded from BidNet. That's an electronic, it's a Hudson Valley Municipal Bid Purchasing System or something like that. But we've also gone electronic on the bid specifications, and that was part of the last administration's paper saving measures, like OnBase. If you don't have a computer, which very few bidders don't, you can purchase a paper copy from ANC. Part of the problem with downloading from BidNet is that maps, plans, technical drawings, blueprints, they're usually in CAD, and you need special software and the big plot printers, so most of the time the contractors don't have that. It's only big engineering firms that can afford that. So you have to come in and buy the blueprints. State law allows us to charge up to $100 for that. That's the maximum ANC can charge. And then if you don't win the bid, you can turn back in and get your money back. Now, when the bids come in, ANC, you know, when it's time to submit the bids, ANC will do a cursory review of the sealed bid to ensure that the bid security is attached, because that's in a separate envelope usually attached to it. If there are blueprints, they check to see if you're on the list who purchased the plans, because if you don't have the blueprints, then you can't submit a realistic bid. If the bid didn't have any blueprints, they can check and see if you downloaded the specifications on BidNet if you didn't buy them. But you have to be on one of those lists. You had to buy the plans if you want a paper copy, or you had to download them or get the specifications. Otherwise, you're not going to accept the bid. Bid openings are done weekly. The law requires at least two representatives of the Board of ANC, but it defines that it's not necessarily a member of the Board of ANC. It can be their designee, so it's usually two staff members of ANC. It's usually done on a Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock. Now, the bid opening determines the apparent low bidder, not necessarily the winner, because we award bids to the lowest responsible bidder, and I'll explain that in a few seconds. The other thing is at the bid opening now, under the new WICS law exceptions, there's a special requirement that you have to have a subcontractor list. So the apparent low bidder for one of those WICS law exception contracts, we have to read the subcontractor list aloud. So that's a new part of...
Could you explain that a little bit? The subcontractor list, what is that?
All I can tell you is it was put into the law, and so if there's a WICS exception, you have to submit your bid in that format where you list all your subcontractors, and then everybody, if you're the apparent low bidder...
How would you fall into the category of WICS exemption?
It depends on the dollar amount of contract. I think Westchester's a million... Rockland's 500,000, New York City's 1.5 million. But if you're over that amount, then you have the, or is it under that amount? I'm sorry. Then you have the WICS exception. And then the only other exception over that is when you have a PLA, Project Labor Agreement. And then if you're above that amount, then you can enter into a PLA and you're exempt from WICS. Okay, the bids come back. ANC's done their first review. They've determined the apparent low bidder. It goes back to DPW at this point because they have to do a detailed review of the apparent low bidder's spec. They've got to make sure that there are no exceptions. You can't negotiate a bid. Not allowed under the law. You have to make sure they properly completed all their bids. For example, it says, we need your plumbing license. Did you attach a copy of your plumbing license? We check the bid bonds to make sure they're good. And then there's the determination of whether or not the bidder is responsible. Past work references, If they haven't worked for us in the past, we can go to third parties because they have to submit third-party references. It's a big job. We may ask to look at their D&B, you know, if they're a large company, or their finances, because we want to make sure they can carry it out. Like the big job that we had for the sewage treatment plants on the Sound Shore. So that's how they determine whether or not the bidder is responsible. And sometimes they have to come to us for legal interpretations because it's basically case law. Once we've gotten through that and determined who the lowest responsible bidder is, then we prepare a new resolution to award the contract. So that's the second step in the public works process. You upload that resolution, it goes into the same process, goes through pre-board into the queue, we review it, goes through pre-board again, and then passes through pre-board to ANC. If it's approved, this is important. The award resolution for a public bid is the county's acceptance of the bid's offer, because you can't negotiate, unlike with other contracts. So there's one slight little exception in the case law that if they commit over budget, we can ask them, would you do the same amount of work for less? That's the only exception the case law allows. And on rare occasions that happens. You know, if they're slightly over what our budget was, sometimes John Shue will go to them and say, could you do it for less? As long as he doesn't reduce the scope of work. And if they say yes, then we can do it for less. But that's the only negotiation that's allowed. Once it's awarded, we now have a legally binding contract. That's even before they sign the piece of paper, because again, there's no negotiation except for that one little exception. And in fact, if they don't sign the contract, I can go after the surety or I can sue them. But that's the difference with public works awards, because again, they're different from all other types of contracts. New York State Office of General Services, this comes under Section 104 of the General Municipal Law, New York State General Municipal Law. Basically, you avoid public bidding because the state's done it for you. They've gone out and they've done these big contracts and you can piggyback on them. And so because of that, state law says you don't have to go out and bid that separately. You may do that. Primarily, the entity that uses this most is the Bureau of Purchase and Supply, because it's mainly stuff. But occasionally, there are service contracts. And again, the exception for under the law for rental leasing of equipment at the rate of $3,000 or more a month, which goes to ANC. So the really big contracts you'll see at ANC. Again, same process. The resolutions are uploaded to OnBase, go to pre-board, and then appear on the ANC agenda. Emergency contracts. This is a special section in the General Municipal Law. In the case of public emergency arising out of accident or other unforeseen occurrence or condition, where the circumstances require immediate action, which can't await public bidding. Since 2002, if you were here, you know why. We've had an internal policy for emergency contracts, and DPW maintains an emergency contractor list, which, you know, if you need more detail, John Shue can explain how he does that. When he procures those, he basically pre-procures those pursuant to the policy. So we have lists of various...
courthouse?
Can you just explain the 2002, just the high level without too much
detail? Without too much detail, there was a contract, I believe, in 2002 for an emergency that happened about 6 months after the emergency, and there was some political fallout from that. I think someone,
what was the emergency?
It was a park, as I recall.
Somebody went to jail
6 months later.
Well, I think they avoided jail, but they just lost their job. But anyway, that resulted in a very detailed policy for dealing with emergency contracts, and DPW now basically has lists, and they roll the people they use. Also, one of the things that Environmental Facilities did, this goes back to when Tony Landy was commissioner, because we kept having pipe breaks. What he would do is go out and basically bid a price. He'd go out and bid a contract for pipe breaks. He'd put so much money in the contract, but every time the pipe broke, he had basically what we call a file price. Someone went out there and said, all right, I'll do your pipe work for X. We generally have to keep adding money to that contract because for budget purposes, you know, you never know how many pipes are going to break, so they only put so much money in there. But that's actually bid, so that's not an emergency contract. Okay. The other thing is Chairman Jenkins knows, it's been policy since 2002 to provide timely notice. As soon as we know there's an emergency, a memo goes to ANC for its next regular meeting. I think part of the problem in 2002 was there was quite a gap in time before the board was notified of the emergency. Now, ANC is notified since the chair of the board sits on ANC. You guys know immediately when the county has an emergency that's going to require an emergency contract. Preferred source procurements. Again, I mentioned NYSID originally. Section 162 of the state finance law not only exempts certain procurements of products and services, but it also requires you to use these designated preferred sources. Basically for public policy reasons, to help the blind, the disabled, people with other handicaps, and also gives the prisons money. There's Corpcraft, we get a lot of our furniture, Corpcraft gets supplies, and they're all made by state prison inmates. This generally affects the purchasing agent, but there are some services that you will see at ANC, primarily janitorial contracts that come through ANC, and also they added recently copying and scanning, because I had a new one for the county clerk that went through NYSID. The process is the procuring agent has to look and make sure and see if one of those services is on the preferred source list, or a good is on the preferred source list, because if it is, you've got to go through the preferred sources. Then you submit a notice of intent. Then they come. I'm sorry. You submit a request to the agency that's the preferred source. They have to within 10 days submit a notice of intent to provide the services. You review the information, and all you're allowed to do is determine whether it meets the form, function, and utility required by the county. There's really no choice here to say yes or no. If it meets that criteria, we have to use that vendor or violate the law. The prices are set by the Commissioner of New York State Office of General Services. OGS determines if the proposed price meets the statutory criteria of being within 15% of the fair market price. Your only challenge is in Article 78. There's no administrative challenge for OGS. There is one for Corpcraft, though, but it takes forever. The procuring department submits an ANC resolution into OnBase. It goes to pre-board and then ANC, just like all the other. This is where the board was visionary. Before the procurement policy required us to have a procurement policy, the Board of Legislators determined that there should be one for architects, engineers, and land surveyors. You did that in a series of legislation starting in 1976 with Act No. 5, which was amended by Act No. 22 in 1992. And then the final step, because I remember I was the lawyer working with Kay Karski on it, was Act No. 44 of 1996, where we created an RFP process for contracts that are expected to be over $100,000. So in brief, you start with the pre-qualification board. They create a uniform qualification form for interested professionals. There are different classes of professionals. And then they review and rate the professionals and create what are called eligible lists of qualified professionals. If a department needs one of these types of professionals, the department head submits a request for a professional to the selection board. Okay, so you don't go to the pre-qualification board, you go to the selection board. If the work is reasonably valued in excess of $100,000, a draft RFP has to be prepared. That was the change we had in 1996. And that gets submitted to the selection board together with a request for selection of a professional. If it's below $100,000, you just submit the selection, the request for the professional. In either case, the pre-qualification board will submit a list of qualified professionals to the selection board. Then the selection board reviews the lists and the draft RFP if the contract's expected to be over $100,000, and it prepares a ranking of the top three professionals. If you're $100,000 or less, there's no formal RFP proposal. The department will then submit a resolution to ANC to obtain a proposal and negotiate a fee. And they from the first rank professional. So for those contracts under $100,000, there's a two-step ANC process. So we do that first resolution. That goes through OnBase pre-board and ANC. So once you get that approval for authority to negotiate, if the negotiations are successful, then you go back to ANC with another resolution to enter into the contract. The difference for the contracts in excess of $100,000, you don't need that first resolution. For authority to negotiate. You just, what happens at this point is you first had a draft RFP that the department gave you, then the selection board requests a final RFP. That goes to the top three ranked professionals. After reviewing the proposals this time, submitted in response to the final RFP, the proposals are then ranked, and the department then submits a resolution to ANC to award to the first ranked professional. Again, all of, depending on whether you're under 100,000 or over 100,000, you're uploaded to OnBase, go to pre-board, then ANC, as I've described previously. The procurement policy. In 1991, New York State adopted section 104-b, which requires an internal policy and procedure for procurements for goods and services not required by law to be subject to competitive bidding. So think about this. If you've got a bid outstanding and it's below the public bidding limit, well, then you're subject to the procurement policy. Same thing for professional services. Professional services, with the exception prior to this of architects, engineers, and land surveyors, had been, you were just exempt. You could pick wherever you wanted. We sometimes did RFPs, but it wasn't required by law. Now you've got to go through a procedure. Now, as I note here, at that time, when we passed this law, we already had the pre-qualification and selection rules. We also had a purchasing act. So take out those things, and that's what we're looking at for the procurement, and also public bidding. So you take out public bidding, too, and the OGS contracts, the preferred source contracts, everything else that's left, and it's basically professional services that are not covered by architects, engineers, land surveyors, and pre-qualification and selection. That's what the procurement policy is covering. Plus, bids right now below $20,000. So if you're not publicly bidding something, then we're using the procurement policy to get at least three quotes.
And what's the sole source?
Sole source? Okay, that's coming up.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Just in answer to your question, the sole source is found in a couple of locations. Sole source is found in public bidding. There's a section of the general municipal law that allows for sole source. And it's also found in the procurement policy. And it's also found in, although it's really not used in pre-qual and selection, it's hard to argue sole source in those circumstances. But there is a section in there. But as you see here, sole source basically means there's nobody else out there. You've done a search of the market, and you have to do this search of the market to determine that there's no one else out there who can reasonably do the job. It's only one entity that can do it. But you got to be careful, particularly in a public bid. If you make your specifications so narrow that only one person could do it, even though it might have been reasonable to have a broader specification, you're going to get slammed in a lawsuit by the competitors of that company. So you have to be very careful, and generally if someone's making a sole source application, they've got to come through law first, because I'm not going to let it go through ANC unless...
Have you ever done that? Are there any examples where we actually...
The thing I find it most often with is software, because software is licensed. One company owns the intellectual property rights to it, and they're it. So particularly when we buy a system or we have a custom-made system done for us, it would cost you, you know, 10 times the price to go out and rebuild your whole system. So when you're buying the annual maintenance and the patches, you're stuck basically with that company, and that's an easy sole source argument for me. Okay, now going through the procurement policy, these are the steps that a department's procuring officer has to follow. They have to determine if the subject matter falls under any of the exemptions in Section 3A. There are a number of exemptions there. Your Honorable Board approved all of them. Some of them are absolutely necessary because you'd have a conflict of law situation. Some were discretionary with the Board. Then your next step, if you can't find an exemption under Section 3A, now you're going to have to follow the procedures for procurement policy. Those are found in Sections 5, 6, and 7. 5A covers procurements from $0 to $20,000. 5B covers procurements from $20 up to $74,999. And then Section 6 covers competitive procurements, RFPs, $75,000 and over. And then Section 7 is for specific professionals, and that you have to actually go back to the exemption that isn't an exemption, and you can ask Tom Abernathy about that, because we put it in as an exemption, and turned it into a non-exemption when we did that one. But when you're you read section 3A10 for lawyers and certain other professionals, it starts out reading like an exemption, defines a class of professionals, and then says, it's exempt as long as you follow section 7 of the procurement policy, which is a whole RFP section. So you really have no exemptions for those classes of professionals. You read that list and the exemptions of who affected professionals are, then go directly to Section 7 to figure out what your process is. As we just talked about before, sole source, there's an exemption in Section 9, so that you also look for that, but again, you go through law if you're making a sole source argument. Okay. Next step is preparing the ANC resolution, entering the contract. The cover memorandum must recite how the department complied with the procurement policy. It's either got a list of an exemption from procurement, or it's got to say that we've done an RFP, or we got quotes, depending on what the dollar amount is, because that's one of the things I'll kill it for in pre-board if it doesn't have that information in there. And again, all of the above described resolutions are uploaded into OnBase. They go to pre-board and then to ANC. And that's it.
Wow. That was easy.
That was amazing.
It's not that easy.
I also current chair and our past chair who sat on ANC, if they have any observations, that would be very helpful too. But
let's hey, Bill, go ahead.
He was excellent. I happen to know for probably not a bad tuition. He'd be willing to take you through 6 months of that. I thought it's an excellent summary, and it's interesting. It gives you some idea, because I know there are questions all the time, and all you have to do is occupy the corner office, and you get a lot of questions from legislators. But this overview answers questions that come up all the time from legislators on process. And, why does this happen, and why does that happen? Why the delay? Why could we expedite it? There are important steps and controls along the way, and a lot of it, when you actually step back, a lot of it proves to be administratively steps that help ensure the degree of control you need, but also an efficient system that you can count on not to make exceptions, to handle things properly each and every time, excluding the exceptions of the law provides.
Cameron Jenkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and certainly the experience has been mixed, which is why we're going through this process now of looking at ANC modifications. Whether it's to the bar thing that says, well, we just need to blow up the whole thing and start figuring out how to do this in a different way versus modifications along the way. In the legislation prepared by the law department that they strongly suggested no matter what we do at the end that we take this opportunity to kind of streamline the process because it's in many different places. And if you saw the package, it's in your legislation. I mean, ANC is referred to in probably no less than 30 or 40 different places, on how to do that and take this opportunity to have a process that's more transparent, that's more open, and to let there be some kind of accountability and the transparency in the process. The example we had from this morning, there was a question this morning on the resolution that we had in the budget and appropriations on, well, do we have an opportunity to ask questions? As Jim clearly pointed out, in the process in pre-board, we have an opportunity to ask a set of questions. And by the time, I usually review it, and I'm not sure what day Bill did it, but I usually do that today on Tuesdays, and I spend an hour and a half, 2 hours with the budget staff and go through our ANC agenda to see the items that people might have concerns of, whether legislators directly contact you, which that happens, or they contact the budget staff, or our colleagues on both sides of the aisle. We whatever questions people have, we will follow through on because it's the board. And for example, last week we laid over 9 items, and usually it's not because of the items themselves, it's because we didn't receive the communications back that we were required to be able to explain to members and to the public why we were making a certain action or why we were doing that. So there's a lot of nuances in it in the pre-qual process. There's another piece of legislation that we're working on as far as improving the process for DBE and MWBE folks, which you can see in the pre-qual area, how that area, how does someone get on the pre-qual list? You know, how does that happen? And do we do a regular review and refresh, etc.? Or is the same group of people always in that pre-qual list, and we're not necessarily getting the quote-unquote best price and the best value because we, you know, precluded people from that process. So we got to keep going through that. The subcontractor things, we look through the process on when we have a winning bidder and they have subcontractors, how many times, you know, the Ken Jenkins company wins the bid but has a different subcontractor, and is that an indication of them just winning the bids from the pre-qual process because they were on the short list and being a contractor themselves and contracting the work out? So there's a bunch of things that we've been going through, including the NYSED. We had a good experience with the college because the college just had to move towards the NYSED contract in New York State process with the their janitorial service, right? So they had a contractor that was there, an incumbent, that was put out that was not allowed to bid because of the NYSED contract, and we have those kind of things. You know the issues that we've had with the emergency contractual procedure, especially given the fact that the board, through a resolution of the board, said there was no longer an emergency and we didn't need to move forward on a specific item, and there's some gray area in how that whole emergency process works that we need to clear up. I mean, from a process perspective, there have been items added, and Jim is just, you know, a wealth of experience because he's been there so long through all of the modifications that have been made in the ANC process, and other folks, of course, that have been around as well. But Jim from the law department's been around to understand some of the reasons things got put in the way that they did, and now we're having this opportunity to clean it up. So I'm looking forward to the continuing dialogue and how we do the shaping of this, because that there's a lot of things that go on in the background that, I mean, you know, 21-page form doesn't even, you know, get close to showing the level of detail of how it gets from point A to point B. And the work that law does a lot of, right, that at the end, when we get to ANC, when it's a board meeting, you know, when we get to our board meeting, things kind of move quickly because all the work was done in committee. Well, pre-board is that similar kind of activity, and they do a lot of that work. The ANC group downstairs does fantastic work as far as working with the law department, making sure things get notified. We have questions on things like the newspaper requirement. We saw that the bids for the last set of activities were only in the lower part of Westchester as far as the bids were concerned, and we're going to look at that and understand why.
I know what the history of that is. Yeah. It was basically a cost-saving measure, because I participated in the outreach for MBEs and WBEs, and nobody uses the newspaper, really, for bids anymore. It's sort of a hang-up from history. It's in state law and local law, but contractors go on the internet now to look for it,
right,
for bids. And even our RFPs are on a separate website for doing business with the county, but we use BidNet because that has the ability for downloading specifications. And that was one of the things that we were very clear on to the contractors when we do the outreach under Section 308. And you really should have John Hsu up here because it's he and Donna do that portion of it. We don't get involved in the legal portion, but they explain how you can, you know, particularly minority businesses and women-owned businesses, how you go, where you look for these things, because the newspaper is the wrong place to look.
And the question is from cost savings, again, things like saying, all right, well, if we're going electronic, then, you know, should we be doing a newspaper, a printed version at all, right?
Or modifying the state law requires
and figure out how to deal with that.
Until the newspaper is removed from Albany or that law, you know,
But wasn't, if I may, Bill, wasn't there discussion at NYSAC last year? I remember you mentioned that when you came back.
Yeah, I mean, at one time it worked, and communities not only had one newspaper, they had many newspapers, and legislative bodies would sit down and select who would be the newspaper of record, and all the legal advertising would go in there. Decades later...
You still have that resolution.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I use when we have to publish.
Yeah, decades later...
We do it every January 1st.
Just as Jim was pointing out, people get their information from other sources. Many newspapers have trouble keeping, you know, over-the-counter sales and subscription sales at a level where you can sustain the operation. Yet the law still is requiring that we designate newspapers of record and we put, you know, advertising of our business into those. So I think that, you know, hopefully sooner rather than later, state legislature will realize that times have changed, and they'll still find that it's very desirable to allow the greater public to know, you know, what is going on. But they'll turn to the newer sources of information, and but that, you know, that doesn't happen yet. And also, you know, it requires the counties that are substantial operations like Westchester, Nassau, Suffolk, Erie, appropriate money for that and pay big sums to newspapers that really aren't reaching that many people today as they used to reach. One of the things, John, you mentioned about just a take as a chair. You know, not only well, for purposes of this discussion, there are probably from board to board. Legislators come and go, who don't understand the amount of time that goes into A and C. And it's not that you work hard to get it done and now it's done and over with. It is a process that repeats itself week after week after week throughout the year, and then the second year and the third year. For however long you serve here, that process is ongoing. And the way it's set up, for our purposes, you know, sometimes we've seen a knee-jerk reaction to A and C decisions. The knee-jerk happens at the Board of Legislators where they...
Can I interrupt you for a second? Before you leave, we have one other chair in the room. Are you leaving, George?
No.
Okay, good. I just wanted to get your take. You're a former chair, too. So. Go ahead.
It's not his favorite subject.
Oh, yeah, I
didn't say. Go
ahead. The knee-jerk usually occurs when A and C takes an action and it's been perceived as the executive branch outvoting the legislative branch and doing something that the legislative branch did not want done. And then you'll see calls from individual legislators, you know, this was wrong, they shouldn't have that authority. If they have to explain to the public, sometimes the public watches some of this that's going on, the public will raise a question, how could the county do that? How could this body, the A and C, Board of Acquisition and Contract, do that? Where's the control? Legislators, can't you control them? Legislators will come back and say, well, you know, it's a 2-to-1 vote, really. It's 2 votes for the executive, 1 for the board. So we, even voting in opposition, we know it's going to pass. So then you'll hear the calls for change that. Shift the power, the weight on the board, or eliminate the A and C board, and let that function be put back into the hands of the Board of Legislators. Well, you know, I'll tell you something. Can you imagine? Well, maybe, you know, Ken will appreciate this. George Orwell will. If you've got 20, 30, 40 contracts a week that you have got to understand, look into, understand, ask questions about before you can responsibly vote as chairman representing the entire legislature at that table. If you have that on an ongoing basis, you have to invest the large amount of time in the prep for that meeting. Putting that back into the hands of the legislature means that we then, at least as a majority of board members, Democrats and Republicans alike, but at least the majority of the legislators would have the responsibility to set aside the time each week to go through and learn about and understand and ask questions and get a handle on dozens and dozens of contracts. Why? Because there, a board has been abolished, and we decided that collectively we wanted to take on the responsibility. We will approve it. And so we would have to go into the chamber and approve all of these items every week in a formal meeting of this legislature. And I've been here since 1998, and I've been at meetings where that has been said, that some members over the years have preferred that all of this be put into the hands of the legislature. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that our budget staff wouldn't have the same difficult job each week to get the answers to questions that the legislature needs. But instead of coming back and getting to the chairman at different points during the week with the information to continue the conversations, they then in turn would have to report back to the full board. They're willing to do that. But is the Board of Legislators willing to be around each and every day of the week on the off chance that today's the day we've got most of the information we can give to you, all in preparation for the meeting that you have to come back and attend, say on Thursday, when the full board convenes to take up 40 contracts. So, you know, there's a, I know it's oversimplified, but the thing is, you have to think long and hard before you reach a point where all of a sudden the legislature would step in. I mean, we already have a role. Before ANC can do things, there has to be statutory authority. A lot of that statutory authority is authority that we have already given through the passage of legislation on the floor of the county board. We have already gone through the budget meetings and the other meetings where we learn about the item of legislation that's before us. We've already made the decision to report it to the floor. We've already come together as a majority of at least 9, sometimes more, to handle items out on the floor. And the items I'm talking about are the items that give statutory authority to the ANC board to then go through the contracts process they go through. So it's not quite as simple as hearing from your colleagues over the past decade, just do away with ANC. It is not quite as simple as the self-anointed government operations experts that are out there in and around the county. Some of them are local government officials who come forward suggesting that they know how to streamline county government. Start with ANC, abolish it. It's not all that simple. There are reasons why you may want to hold on to some of these things, because from an administrative standpoint, operational efficiency, it makes sense. Of course, the question of modifying things, tweaking things, when you think things can be improved, of course you do that. No one's going to stand in the way of that. But some of the things that have been suggested over the years aren't near misses on the target. They are shots wide to the right and left. And if we ever took that kind of action, we'd be worse off for it.
Thank you. Another former chair in the room, and then we'll open up for questions. George Oros, and currently chief of staff, what's your view? I know you proposed some reforms.
Yeah, I think Bill summed it up very well, because in some respects, it's better than most other counties, in the sense that there are a lot of places where these types of contracts and bids are just awarded and nobody knows about it. I would say 90%, and Bill and Kent can bear this out, 90% of what appears on ANC has been done through the legislature, because it's a bond act you approve and it goes to the lowest bidder. All the IMAs, somewhere along the way, this legislature required all IMAs to come to the full legislature. So you'll see a lot of times IMAs, like for instance, tonight you have one up in my neck of the woods, I think it's in his correspondence, for Oscar Park. You'll approve that IMA down here, and about 2 or 3 weeks later, it'll appear on ANC as an action. So, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I do agree there are things you can do, and as a legislator, one of the things I was concerned is the Board of A&C locking the county into any kind of long-range, long-term obligation that the legislature is going to vote on. So, for instance, leases that go beyond 5 years. And I know Jim's going to say they're only 5 years, but there are 2 5-year renewals on that. So, 1 5-year renewal. So, you could, you know, for instance, if they wanted to, if there was something last year, the prior administration could have locked in this administration that came in to a 10-year type of lease where we, you know, may or may not like it. So, without the Board of Legislators weighing in. So that was one of the changes I think we made. The other change that we had proposed in that legislation was taking DPW commissioner out and putting the budget director in. And that was a realization. I think A&C was established in 1937, Jim Webb. And, you know, if you probably looked at what this county did in 1937, 75 or 80% of what it did was public works projects. If you look at it today, probably 60-70% of what it does is more social service programs, IMAs, where our local governments, things like that, where the budget director probably has a broader view of all of the different aspects of what county government does, and goes through his department. I can't remember, we'll see, there are three major things.
Emergencies.
You went into emergency.
Emergency.
Well, a number of us were here when that incident occurred, and we did try to close that loophole about having a list, because what was happening is emergency would be declared and then just go out and grab somebody. And we always felt that there should be a, you know, just like when you do these towing contracts on a parkway or something, where you have a rotating list of providers so that the same person isn't always getting the emergency contract or getting the emergency service. So.
Okay, thanks. Questions from the board? Mr. Rogowski, should wait in the Mr. Hart.
Just a couple. I've always been intrigued by a contract being approved by A&C and then extensions a year later, dollars change and numbers change, and it never, I mean, it's just my take on this, I may have missed something, that it seems it didn't go back through, it could be 2, 3, 4 years later, didn't go back. Is that how it works? I didn't see in your procedures.
What will happen sometimes is, and I saw this recently with one, where they had an RFP, and it had, within the RFP terms, it had options for extensions, and when they did the first resolution, they forgot to mention that.
Okay, so
they had to go back shamefacedly and say, oops, we
so
forgot.
It's
I double-checked that and made
like
sure the RFP
third amendment, but if the RFP, so the RFP itself.
Yeah, the original procurement had to have something in there, because otherwise how are you, did you know what price you were getting?
Well, that's why I was so only if the original RFP said over time this contract can come back and there'll be.
Yeah, and again, the only other time that I'll let it go is if on the topic we were talking about earlier, sole source. We have an awful lot of software contracts and, you know, things that are very specific, whether intellectual property rights. And once we've gone in and we've done the RFP and bought the system, and this is the only vendor who has the IP rights to that.
So what I may have seen it is
unless you're ready to do a major capital project to gut the thing and redo the whole new system, you're basically stuck with that vendor for all your software and maintenance updates. It's like with Microsoft. You know, once you bought Microsoft, you have to buy the upgrades and the patches.
I'll keep watching. So it could be sole source and maybe professionals where it goes on. There's no requirement.
Professionals make sense. I mean, theoretically, you could switch horses in midstream on a project, but then you have to bring the new professional up to speed. Now, that's not to say that you wouldn't want to do that in certain cases where the professional's prior services were no good, and then it's worth spending the money. But in many cases where you have a professional who started, for example, phase one of a project, you know you're going to spend a lot of time if you go out and change to another engineer or something like that, or in my case, another lawyer who's unfamiliar with it. We would normally only change from the middle of the case, the lawyers, doing an adequate job.
Over the years, I've seen
because you know you're going to pay to educate. Because the new professional comes in, you're going to be spending a lot of money educating that professional, bringing them up to speed.
We have that with accounting firms sometimes.
True.
And my other question, again, this is something I heard several years ago. Someone was complaining to me, there was concern, and I hope it's not happening. about at the close of the bids. Now, the bids come in online. Is everything like time stamped and date?
It's, we're only doing that, I think, on bonds, but we haven't done a lot of electronic bidding.
So you haven't, so the bids are delivered
bids
in hand,
they're
stamped?
They're sealed bids. Yeah, we have the option to do electronic bidding. We haven't done a lot
of
that.
You don't accept the bids online?
No,
just for the bonds.
Yeah,
just,
we've done it for a couple of bond auctions.
Just bonds, okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is back a couple of years. Okay, so that's, okay. Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great exercise, and I thank you for undertaking it, because, you know, even if we get to a place where we do nothing, we've reaffirmed that perhaps this is working. And I'm saying that's where we are, but that's why it's good to do these exercises once in a while. But we are, Legislator Oros kind of answered my question before I asked it, but I want to put it to Jim and to Chairman Jenkins and former Chairman Ryan. We've heard everything from, as Bill said, disband ANC completely, to George suggested some fixes, and some are saying it's fine the way it is. So I would ask Jim, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, I'm just as somebody who works in the system. Are there ways that you see that we could improve this process that might perhaps add some more transparency or even functionality to the system? And I would ask the same of the chair and the past chair. You know, rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater, are there things we can do to improve the system?
I'll start with you.
You're the featured guest today.
You've had the longest experience.
Okay, you know, I understand that, but understand this. There's certain issues I'll talk about which are, you know, which I feel comfortable talking about, which are, you know, just mechanical things. I realize there are other political issues.
Right. I'm not asking you to address the
political. I don't do policy now. Okay. But when you're looking at the way the process is right now, with the addition of... once you added the presence of Board of Legislators in 2002 to pre-board, they basically have the same access to information that I did, you know, because I'm getting the ANC resolutions at the same time as your budget staff is. So I think that was very mystical in the beginning, what is pre-board. I think when Bob Mullen showed up the first day and realized how boring it is, because we're basically, if you saw my presentation, most of the ANC resolutions are not prepared by the law department. There was a big push on toward the end of the O'Rourke administration, definitely the beginning of the Spano administration. If you recall, when Spano came in, he proposed a 15% budget cut, and I remember Alan Shankman coming up to me and saying, we've got to find a way to cut contract costs for the departments. And so I used to do, I think on an annual basis, Bob Boland used to attend them, a presentation on how to do ANC resolutions. So I taught departmental contract managers how to do them. Then over time, we started teaching them how to do their own contracts, and we would have pre-prepared forms so they could do them. So when you're instead of expanding the law department, because I'd really need, if I were doing all the contract work right now, we'd have a much larger contracts bureau. But this is why pre-board has become so critical, because the departments do most of their own resolutions, and so, you know, when I sit on pre-board, it's like the gatekeeper. I have to make sure they followed all the rules. And to me, as soon as Bob Bowen showed up, and I think you have three or four individuals who show up to the pre-board meeting. You've got some representatives from the majority and a representative from the minority party. And they ask a lot of good questions. And we assign someone, if we can't answer them right there, someone is assigned to get back to them. And then I realize there's a later review by the chair after we have pre-board. So there is a lot more information. In terms of duplication, I could think of, you know, I know that one of the legislative things before you is, you know, there are certain things that get approved by the board. You mentioned IMAs. And because of the way ANC is written, they have to go to ANC again. Same thing with certain leases. Leases, you know, over five and one renewal, you know, they're going to ANC. I mean, they're going, the shorter ones go to ANC, the longer ones go to the board. But then they got to go back again to ANC, even on the long ones, because of the way things are written. So I know that one of the things you're looking at, would be to eliminate that duplication. That might be one thing you want to consider. You might want to consider making some of the, what I'll call the policies law. Right now, since the Spano administration, we've had policies on the emergency contractor list and how they procure those emergency contracts. Now, mind you, that's only for public works contracts. There can be emergencies that are beyond public works contracts, but we really only focused, and this was Larry Schwartz, you'll find it was a memo by Larry Schwartz at the time. Policy was basically just for that kind of thing, because that was the issue that arose at that time. We really don't have policies for other types of emergencies. We still use the old rules for other emergencies, which are found in the statute. But that may be something you want to look at, institutionalizing that policy and making that part of law. One of the things that was talked about was architects, engineers, and land surveyors, and you were talking about changing the pre-qual thing. A word of advice. You've got three individual pieces of legislation that roll past at different times, and they all have to be read together to understand and integrate the process. That's more of a historical problem. If you're changing pre-qual and selection, there are at least two pieces of legislation you have to change, Act 5 of 1976 and Act 144 of 1996, because that's where the main bodies of law are. Act 5 of 32 of 1992, I'll double check that. But the 1992 one was just a dollar amount change. But you've got to go back, because you adopted pre-qualification and selection. That, like the procurement policy, that is your baby. You created that from the get-go, and all the rules were yours. And I know, because I worked on the last set of rules, I think Bush was chairman back then.
Was that 96?
96,
yeah.
Yeah, and budget. Yeah, DNA.
That was his time.
I know Kate Karski was definitely...
He and Sue Swanson, I think.
Yeah, and Sue was involved. But I remember, this was Kate pushed this one, because this was, she was really the one who wanted this. And I remember her being the one who sponsored it. But, you know, maybe you want to integrate all that into one new set of rules.
And Mr. Chairman, just on a point that is one of the suggestions that was made, was to say, you know what, we got things all over the place to get it together and make some modifications, because for the level of work, you know, as Bill was just referring to, Ms. Brown was just referring to, was that we would have 5-hour meetings. You know, every time if we had to do every one of the items, and that's why there were some suggestions on different levels of the short form. For example, the state changed the level from $20,000 to $35,000. Well, maybe that's the level that a short form should be, so it's consistent with state law. Or we write the law that says it's consistent with state law, and then we don't have to change ours every time that there's a modification at the state to change the levels, because, you know, the cost of things change. As far as the people that are involved in the process, you know, we have two elected officials that are on the board, and to determine what the third or who the third person should be, and if we need to make some modifications for the third person, is something that we may want to go down the road and talk about. The budget director certainly sounds like a reasonable person. However, it's not that much different from the charter. The individual that's in that third position needs to be a person that is going to call them down the middle based on the laws. So we got to figure out what other things we might need to do in that case. We may need to modify someone's job description in order to make the satisfaction of, okay, this person understands that if one side or the other is concerned, there'd be an issue. For example, the budget director, all the commissioners only could be removed by the action of the county executive. However, with the budget director, since they have a term, they have to have, in addition to being removed or recommendation for removal by the county executive, requires a 2/3 vote by the board of legislators. Certainly there's some tweaks that we might be able to do in that might make some sense. That could deal with. The other thing is that we might want to look at the exceptions that are in the rules right now, right? That are exempting from the procurement process. You know, the example that I give all the time is the one where we go in to purchase the some video equipment, and because that company was not in our procurement list, we needed to do an RFP for the item. It was a $1,500 item, but we didn't need to do a procurement process. We didn't need to do an RFP for a $45 million contract. Something's wrong there, right? So we gotta figure that out. I mean, on an emergency basis, certainly if there was something that had to happen, it wouldn't be $45 million worth of stuff that we needed to do. You know, and it certainly could be a couple of million dollars, like the rock slide that happened with the sewer pipe, right? So certainly that was several millions of dollars. But you know, those kind of items, I think, are the kind of things that we can deal with. And certainly in the policy part of it, which, and I appreciate Jim's position on that, it's like from a policy, setting up the policy in such a way that we make sure that the board's directives, the board's actions, aren't subverted by this group of individuals, which, you know, the chairman happens to be one, right? So you don't want that to happen. You don't want it, and that's one of the proposals that says, you know, once we enacted something at the board level, that it cannot be modified at A and C for the action, right? You know, maybe there's a savings that could take place, as Jim was talking about, when the contract goes back and forth. But again, those are the kind of things I think overall, and the part of saying, let's have this discussion and let's get it straight. Right? You know, the opposite thing may be true. I mean, I believe we are one of the, I think we're the only county, only one or two that have A and C at all out of the 62 counties, right? So, and obviously that's maybe a good thing and maybe a bad thing. What ways are they doing it? Again, I think that the A and C folks do a great job in that mechanics process, right? You know, the question is, how do we deal with the legislative pieces of it, that when the board makes a decision, that decision actually gets executed, you know, through the contractual process. Maybe it's the law department. Jim pointed out that many of the contracts aren't written by law. They're written by the departments or the
yeah, but they're on approved forms. Right. I mean, we won't let them go through unless they have,
But for streamlining the purposes of that, one of the things that maybe we do is we have that encompassed in law, and law deals with, because you review them all at the end anyway.
Right? Well, by law, we have to review the final contracts. So that's sure. We won't sign off on them unless they have the legal requirements. But I don't make, you know, in a business decision, I don't make a policy choice on behalf of the department.
And that goes back again. So from a policy perspective, in having RFPs for certain activities to make sure that the structure isn't being subverted or utilized in a way it wasn't intended, to make sure that, again, we don't want to have a situation where every contract is in front of the Board of Legislators, but we want to make sure that the process always is followed as far as RFPs. Another example is that we just, in ANC last week, the board overed it 2 weeks ago. We had a request to add 13 attorneys to our internal attorney pool, right? So there were 21 attorneys already on this list to do various work. And
the 6N list?
It's a 6N list, yeah. But just in defense of the law department, I don't make the final call on who gets hired, but... We followed RFPs for both procedures.
We're saying is that there were 21. The reason that the board objected to it was that there were 21 attorneys, firms on this list that went through an RFP process, and the request was to add another 13 because these folks are already under contract. There wasn't a termination of their contract.
But it's easily explainable. I mean, you know, the last RFP was done in the last administration. And this happened even when the Democrats came in. Alan Shankman did a new because O'Rourke had saddled him with a list of attorneys. Now the new administration came in; they wanted to do a new RFP. And it's happened every time a new administration comes in. So we just did another RFP. We followed all the rules as we normally would, and followed the procurement policy to the letter.
But the reason I'm bringing that up again is that the There were 21 attorneys on this list. About 6 or 8 of them had been utilized during the year. And this contract was going to go from September to December, right? So since we're in September now, the point we were raising was, you know what, do your RFP, do it at the end of the year, you make the new policy, of the new group of people effective for January 1st, because the 3 months isn't going to make that much of a difference, you know, to bring in a group of individuals you might be more comfortable with from an RFP perspective. That's the kind of stuff that, at, from an ASC, a policy perspective, that we would, you know, try to avoid. If a new administration takes over, we have people with 5 and 6 year contracts. Those folks are saddled with those individuals when they come in, right? So it's okay, because it goes through the legislative process as well. So again, in fairness, I think that we're going to have a lot of fun tweaking and pulling and pushing, etc. But there should be obviously some changes that are made to the process to increase the level of transparency and openness. We didn't even get to the place, and I hope that you'll ask Joe Mary and the folks from ANC to come to a committee meeting and do a presentation just from their perspective on what things happen in the world that they do. So, for example, right now the minutes of the meeting are not public, right? They're not available online. They're not. The actual resolutions aren't available. And they're tacked to the wall downstairs in the lobby. That's the public notice. The agenda, the latest agenda, is on the website, but none of the past agendas. So even if we got to the place where minutes of the meeting and the agendas were available, that would help increase the process and the transparency. But I'm looking forward to this, Chairman. Thank you for this opportunity. Bill.
Any other comments, questions?
Bill,
are you?
Jim,
Bill,
the
question
was just
a legal
thing.
Bill to respond as well. Oh, all right, sorry. Okay. Bill, back to Peter's question. Any suggestions you would have to improve?
Well, I think that you really need to put into a very realistic context the issue of the board's structure and how it's weighted right now to the executive branch of government, right? And it goes back to the point that the people that have a problem with the 2-to-1 voting at AMC. There have been suggestions over the years that expand the number of members of AMC, but that, and even though the proportion changes, it goes, there was one proposal that took it from 2-to-1 to 3-to-2. But the point was that it still was, the upper hand was still had by the county executive branch in that proposal as well. But what I'm saying is that, you know, unless you structure it the way the election, Board of Elections is structured, where you have basically two commissioners and you have two people making decisions, more often than not, they make the decision that's in line. They both are together on a proper decision. You'll see that every once in a while. You'll see an issue that has to be decided elsewhere. Sometimes it gets thrown into court. But unless you decide that ANC is going to be a panel that has a membership where the executive branch and the legislative branch carry equal weights, you're not really going to satisfy those who are calling for more fairness, greater weight being assigned to the legislature. My point about put that issue into a very realistic context. I don't know whether or not you need to be looking for new weights to the acquisition and contract board. I really don't. And the fact that we have had an opportunity out on the floor of the board to consider many of these issues, to take votes, to provide authorization for AMC to do what it's going to need to do. We have had substantial input. Now you get to the point of the votes upstairs. More often than not, there is no problem. Every once in a while there'd be a problem, and once again, usually it's a minority view. I'm not talking about Democrat-Republican minority. It's a minority view on the decision that the ANC board has made. But I got to tell you, 99 and probably 9/10 of the time, the decisions that are made upstairs turn out to be unanimous. It's a very high percentage, whatever it is. And it's unanimous because the county executive has been briefed from A to Z on the details of the item. Our staff briefs us through the chairman's office on the details of the item. And we reach this consensus, yes, this is something that ANC should move forward forward with. It's not a situation where every single week out of the year, the legislature and the executive are battling over every item up there. That's not the case at all. There are items that come up. You know of many of the ones that commanded headlines. But more often than not, all of the professionals in the room reach the consensus on what the vote should be on the items before the ANC board, and that's what in fact happened. So I don't know whether it's worth our while to spend a whole lot of energy and time trying to figure out some new way to reweight the panel. If it was a much bigger problem and it was persistent down through time, through the different administrations, then I'd say, yeah, invest time on it. I'm not convinced that that's our number one priority.
Let me, if I may, just a follow-up. Bill, if I can, you mentioned, you know, it's very smooth with the notable cases, you know, one or two here and there. But let's, you know, one really big one recently was the prison healthcare contract,
right,
which was a huge contract that was done without RFP, a lot of political consternation on both sides of the aisle. And a lot of us felt that a contract that big, A, should not have been rushed through, and B, there should have been some public input. So, and I ask this in sincerity, are we willing to let, you know, one like that squeak through and have an overall good system, or is there a way that, you know, we capture those lemons that you know, that's the really big one that you know, was the flaw in the system?
Well, here's your alternatives. If you think that happens, even if it happens once, it's too often. If you can end up with two other alternatives. One where it's equal weighting, and obviously you're going to get 1-1, 2-2, 3-3, and it's going nowhere. Or you can somehow flip the thing, and now the legislature would have the superior number of votes upstairs. Really aren't a lot of alternatives to the way it's weighted now. I don't know. I could very easily make an argument for the legislature in light of the fact that 17 of us are representing close to 1 million people in this county, and theoretically they all want us to weigh in on their behalf. You can make that argument that it should be perhaps in our hands. But unless you flip it, that's the only way that you're going to be able to guarantee that the view of a majority of the board, even on a day when you find yourself in a minority on an issue, that the majority, the consensus opinion of the majority, is the one that controls. And, you know, that's a different, you know, it's a different issue that I don't think we've ever really taken up. Although, once again, there have been proposals in front of us, that one of which I remember, where the legislature would have a superior number of votes.
Any other questions, comments? We've been going a while. I'm going to just try to summarize some of the comments made, where I think we're going, and what we propose to do at the next meeting where we address this topic. Certainly the issue of ANC reform, you know, is something that's floated around for a long time, and I've heard about it ever since I came to this legislature two and a half years ago. The current county executive had it in his campaign platform, a proposal to reform ANC. George Oros, as he mentioned, had a proposal several years ago to reform ANC. Ken Jenkins and I proposed a proposal to reform ANG, ANC. There's been these proposals out there, and I think we need to move forward and decide what needs to be done. I'm now coming to the conclusion, and I think others have expressed this, Chairman, former Chairman Ryan, very strongly, that it doesn't make sense to abolish the board of ANC. And thank you, Jim Robinson, for coming and explaining the process as we have been appreciated at this meeting. This is a very complex, careful process that's built up over the years. Now, maybe it's built up in a way where you've got some policies piled on some policies piled on some policies. You need to rationalize them and coordinate them and simplify them so that it works more efficiently. But I don't think we're ready to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think Chairman Ryan has made some good points about, you know, you're never really going to play around with the waiting, but maybe there's a better person that should be that third person. I think that's all issues we need to discuss and put on the table. I think the issue that Legislator Harkin raised about a contract of the magnitude of health care for the correctional facilities, we need to determine if there's any way to prevent contracts like that from kind of slipping through, but being awarded without greater legislative input, let's put it that way. And there is a fair amount of legislative input for this process, so I don't think we need to throw out the Board of Acquisition and Control. I think we just need to see if there's our contracts that should be before the legislature that are not now before the legislature. You know, there's been a number of points that Jim Robinson has raised we ought to consider involving leases and IMAs and possible duplication there. Policies that maybe should be codified into law. This is, you know, obviously a complex process. I think we need to look at transparency issues. Chairman Jenkins has raised the issue of minutes not on the website, the resolutions not being on the website, and maybe prior agendas being made available. I think we need to look at the pre-qualification process and maybe the emergency awarding of emergency contracts, that process. I would suggest that the next meeting, we have this legislation that's been drafted. I think the next meeting I would propose that we have the county attorney come and explain the legislation that's been drafted. And if Jim Roberts is available, Jim, maybe we'd ask you to come just in case of questions. I know you didn't draft it. We're going to have the drafter come and explain it. So in case issues come up.
Consultant to the drafter.
Right.
There's a different unit of our office that does that.
So if that's okay with everybody and Mr. Chair, that's okay with you, that would be our next step, would have the county attorney and maybe Jim come with them and have the county attorney, the drafter, explain the legislation and what it purports to accomplish. And then we can decide, you know, really what we need to do with it, whether we need to move forward with any of that or not, if there's anything we need added. And then subsequent meetings, we can have the actual people that work up or do all the background work come and explain to us.
But you have to understand the legislation that we drafted, I mean, there were two different pieces.
There are two pieces.
Well, one of them was to eliminate ANC, so we weren't looking at some of these broader issues that you've been talking about now. If you're going to retain ANC and we're sort of rationalizing the process, those were ideas I think we threw out in a memo, but that's not what the legislation does. You would have to take a very different look at what's in front of you.
It gives you an idea of
everything that has to be changed. If you take out the word ANC, there is a massive amount of legislation that has to be changed because it goes back to 1937, and it's not only in local laws, it's in acts, you know, and so it's
But it will give us a picture of
it. It gives you an idea how big it is.
Yeah. I think that would be helpful.
Ms. Chairman, I think that's the excellent process that you're talking through. For me, as a person that is on ANC and goes through this process, seeing when we, you know, the proposal to say, well, if we abolish ANC, what would be needed to be done? Right, and seeing the plethora of things doing it, I think it's good because I think it'll look at some of the duplication errors. Because you look at some of the areas and you go, well, why is ANC even involved in this thing at all? Right, and that may be the elimination in that particular aspect of it. So I think that process sounds fantastic. It's again continuing moving the ball in a direction, and then, you know, the tweaks that we may have to do, you know, at the end,
well, just
pull it all together.
You know, Ken and I had talked offline one day, which is about total volumes, and there, on average, is about 14 to 15,000 resolutions from ANC a year. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are procedural. You know, it's not necessarily new contracts. I can have one resolution that has 200 contracts, you know, the children with special needs. I mean, you don't have any choice in those. You have a $22 million contract, and New York State saying, you know, throw on the list, you're hiring. So, because we had been talking about if you had this dollar amount that had to go to the board, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. It's not like there's a policy decision to be made.
Yeah, the OGS ones are almost
And the OGS ones are already bid. And, you know, so it's very difficult to create, you know, sort of like gross levels if you were to take a dollar number and say it should go to the board without having a lot of exceptions, mm-hmm. because you really would have to go through all these various agendas and look at the examples of different contracts and say, does this really make sense being with the board or not? Because there's an awful lot of busy work that ANC does, which I described in part in my...
I think there's advantage to just looking at a process that's built up over time, over so many years, and just seeing how that process is working and whether it could be improved in any way. Any other comments, thoughts?
You know, it's interesting, not to get ridiculous, but a legislature that has problems with the county executive wants to, let's get away from this board and some future time. You know, a legislature has problems with the county executive and they want to ensure that they always have the greater weight at an ANC board that still exists in some future time. You can conceive of them taking the actions they have to take, and then you get to the point of actually executing the contract, and you have the clash of the powers of the two branches mm-hmm, when the mm-hmm. executive decides, well, I'm not going to execute the contract, which raises the whole question, and this has come up also within the past decade, the contracting authority of the Board of Legislators independent, as an independent branch of government. We had talked earlier, maybe about an hour or so ago, this, somebody made reference to the 16111. I think you mentioned, John, the county executive has the authority through written authorization to grant to department heads, board and commission heads, the authority to contract up to a certain level, Jim mentioned. And the practice over the years has been like $20,000, but actually it's whatever the amount is that is in the particular memo or letter that the county executive writes, which raises an issue in my mind. Over the years, at least the time I've been here, there's a resolution, I believe, that is passed at the beginning of each ANC session, beginning of the year, which basically reinforces all of that. And one of the entities on the receiving end of the writing is the County Board of Legislators. And the practice has been, for a decade, if not more, that our contracting authority is granted and then limited to the $20,000. The question, which clearly you are all aware of, is you've got one branch of government granting an authority to another branch of government, in this case, the county executive giving the legislature permission and setting the limit that the legislature will be restricted to, which it might be interesting as law comes back with a presentation. I'd be very interested in their take on whether or not, one, the county executive can in fact grant permission to this legislature to contract if he has the authority. Absent giving that authorization, are our hands tied? And two, can a county executive, the executive branch, set the limit of the legislative branch's action with respect to that function? I'm not so sure that the Board of Legislators hasn't just been over many, many years just put into this collective bucket of departments and commissions and boards, lowercase b, mm-hmm. not Board of Legislators. I think we're in a different end. But I want to continue on here.
Very helpful.
Having an education.
Anything else? Anybody? Do you have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Does the administration have the same 20,000? Limit? John? Does the administration?